Hey, deserving listeners, it's just me today. I thought I would respond to an email from famous patron Lyndon, in which he asked me the following thing. But before I do that, let me introduce the podcast. This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast, and I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. This email is from patron Lyndon, famous patron Lyndon, who runs our Facebook fan group. If you want to join the Facebook fan group, it's a fun place to interact with other deserving listeners. And patron Lyndon says, "Hi, Kirk. You've talked a few times about how many counselors don't know enough about particular topics. For example, you've talked about how counselors don't know enough about anxiety and trauma therapy. I wonder if sometime you would do an episode about those areas which are widely considered significant and yet which many clinicians tend to have very little training for, like a top 10 or something." Top 10. I like lists of top 5, top 10. So here we go. This is my top 10 neglected areas of knowledge within the field of psychotherapy. Yeah, number one, trauma therapy and PTSD and dissociation, kind of lumping all those things into one. The vast majority of our clients have been traumatized, at least in some way, and are suffering from some trauma reaction, whether it's full-blown PTSD or full-blown dissociation or some other issue. And there's so, and it's, and everyone understands the field of trauma, but in my experience, very few people understand the nuances, and many clinicians are actually providing therapy that is not only just ineffective, but maybe harmful to clients. I talk about this on the podcast all the time, when I was at the beginning of my career, I was one of those people. I didn't know. I thought I knew about trauma, and I thought I knew about PTSD, and I thought I knew about dissociation, and I thought I knew about trauma therapy, but I didn't really. And I was harming clients, frankly. Clients would come to me, and I would provide what I thought to be what was taught to me and what people were doing around me. I just sort of provided that approach, and clients would not come back to therapy. Not because they hated me, but because they had become dysregulated by my approach to their trauma treatment. And so that's an absolute neglected area of knowledge. It's changing slowly over time, but there are many people who are excellent in this. But I would say if you just took a poll of all the different clinicians who see clients with trauma, I would say a small minority of people are actually knowledgeable enough to actually do a good job. Okay, so that's number one. Number two is anxiety, just in general. Again, you'd think this would be an easy topic for everyone to understand, but it's actually not, I don't think, in my experience, understood by clinicians, particularly how it presents in children and adults. So it's, in terms of the way it presents, if someone comes to you and says, "I'm anxious," then I think a lot of therapists probably know what to do. But a lot of people don't know they're anxious, or they don't know how to describe their anxiety or something, particularly kids, right? And so anxiety, I find myself in supervision trying to help a lot of people understand what anxiety looks like in children and teenagers and adults who don't know what anxiety is. So, and again, you would think I think it's one of the most, if not the most common category of psychopathology, the most prevalent area of mental illness that people suffer from. I have suffered from panic and some generalized anxiety in my past. And I found that when I went to therapy, a lot of therapists just didn't really, they were sympathetic or empathetic, but they just didn't really know how to target the anxiety and how to really help me reduce my symptoms. What ended up helping me actually for myself was that I just learned about anxiety in depth and about how to treat it in depth, and then just did it to myself, which had a huge amount of benefits to me. I don't suffer from anxiety that much anymore, but boy, did I suffer from it in my 20s. And I mean, I still have tendencies, but there's so many angles to come at anxiety. I think I think there's a lot of clinicians who have never suffered from anxiety themselves, and so they see it as this really simple problem to solve. You know, you do a little bit of CBT and everything's okay. That's my anecdotal experience, but you have to come at it from a lot of different angles. It's not just a simple coping mechanism issue. There's a lot of things. There's trauma involved, but I don't know. It's complicated. Anyway, number three of my top 10 neglected areas of knowledge, and these aren't in any particular order, by the way. Number three is erotic transference and erotic countertransference. So I've talked about this in the podcast before, but it's a neglected area of knowledge in terms of there are many people who will graduate from a master's program or a doctoral program having never even had the notion brought up that a client could be attracted to you or you could be sexually attracted to your client, and that this is normal within certain ranges, and there are things you can do about it, and you're supposed to talk about it. That is completely ignored in our field because our society completely ignores this sort of thing. So, and in our field, it's ignored, in my estimation, largely because of two reasons. One is that we're super puritanical in America and just avoid anything having to do with genitals or eroticism, or it's just we avoid it all, unless it's like in very specific kinds of contexts, like a beer commercial can absolutely have sexual overtones, you know, that kind of stuff. But if a therapist were to announce, "I'm sexually attracted to one of my patients," a good number of people would get stressed out just by you just saying that. But of course, we're human beings. Of course, it's going to happen, right? And so, and by not talking about it, then it results in bad things. You know, we're humans. We're not robots. It's normal to, you know, have a crush on somebody. It's just, it's what you do with it. And so one reason is just our puritanical. The other side is that we have this very adolescent black and white understanding of what creepiness is, for lack of a better term. And so and I've actually experienced this before with trainees and supervisees and other therapists. If someone starts talking about erotic counter transference, meaning that the therapist has erotic feelings for a client, a good number of people, clinicians, you know, these are professionals. A good number of these professionals will sort of giggle and make like a creepy, you know, "Oh, that's creepy." And there's this, it's a very adolescent way of looking at real human feelings. It's like, "Oh, that's so creepy. Oh my God." You know, it's that kind of attitude. And I find that just to be so strange. And of course, it exhibits everyone's insecurity and perhaps traumas and shame around this sort of stuff. But at the same time, it's like, we're professionals now. We should be able to talk in a mature manner about the reality of humans. So anyway, number three, erotic transference, erotic countertransference in my top 10 neglected area of knowledge. Number four, how to find and understand research. Now, for doctoral people, they often don't suffer from this, but maybe some do. But this is more of a problem for master's level people. And in my program, in my master's program, we try to alleviate this by having classes that are specifically designed to help students, help trainees understand how to find and how to understand research, how to look up research, how to read research. And I can tell you from personal experience that for myself, that for many years, I didn't understand how to read research. I would look at journal articles and most of it would just kind of boggle me. At this point in my career, after getting my doctorate and after my dissertation and after writing, you know, or working on books that have a lot of research that I'm reviewing, and just having read literally, I don't know, tens of thousands of journal articles, you realize that there's a format to it. And so I can read journal articles a lot faster now. I can sort of skip around the article and figure out what I need to look at. Whereas before, I was just like, what is going on? You know? And so I feel like that's a neglected area, because all of us clinicians should be using empirical evidence to guide our assessment and treatment of humans. It doesn't mean that we have to be rigid to manualized treatment modalities, but at the very least, we should be familiar with research. For instance, every clinician, in my opinion, if a client comes in and say, you know, the client is talking about anorexia or non-suicidal self-injury or something, every therapist after the session, in my opinion, should immediately go to the literature and just either refresh themselves about what the literature is saying and the treatment that is recommended regarding that. But, or if they don't know much about it, they should definitely look up the literature. And this means that you have access to journals, which means you have to pay money to have access. Now, I'm a professor, so I have full access to everything, which is, you know, a huge benefit to my life. But full disclosure, before I had access, there was a time when I wasn't teaching, and full disclosure, I didn't subscribe to a service that provided me with access to journals. So I'm just as guilty as this. And in fact, I think I did before I got my doctorate, I was woefully, I already mentioned that. So I'm not saying that this is anything that I wasn't, neglectful of. I think it's partly a problem of our profession in that we don't help people enough to understand research and to understand how to use research in their clinical work. I think that for me, and I'm guessing for a lot of other clinicians, it's just so daunting, and there's so much confusion and self-esteem problems as you approach something that you're not very good at in terms of reading research, that you just avoid it, which is what I did anyway. So that's number four. Number five on my top 10 neglected areas of knowledge: how to handle difficult clinical moments. My dissertation was on the experience of difficult clinical moments for seasoned psychotherapists, and they told me that they felt afraid and confused. So there are difficult moments while you're working with a client. You know, they might start yelling at you, or they might have a meltdown, or something difficult happens in session, and then what happens for the therapist? Well, they almost universally said that they felt afraid, like terrified, deer in headlights kind of a situation, confusion. They often felt inadequate. They felt an urge to run away. They might even get angry at the client for making them feel this way. So there's a lot of feelings, and there's very little talk about this in training programs, because they're kind of rare, but they do happen. But I think they're rare enough that training programs don't feel the necessity to talk about it. Also, they don't talk enough about how to handle it. Whenever I lecture about difficult clinical moments, people always will say, okay, great, now you've explained that there are difficult moments that we can all identify with, but what are we supposed to do in those moments? And it's complicated because, you know, like in my study, some people told me about situations in which their client was extremely angry at them and screaming at them, or another situation in which a client showed up with a gun to session, and they didn't brandish the gun, but the gun was in the holster. The word brandish is funny. Do we use brandish for anything other than guns or weapons? You know, they're brandishing a sword or brandishing a gun. You know, I don't say, that guy is really brandishing his pencil. He pulled out his pencil and brandished it. You know, I just find certain words like that funny. But anyway, so we neglect how to handle difficult clinical moments. We neglect even the very notion that therapists would even have difficult clinical moments. That's why I focused on seasoned psychotherapists in my study, because I wanted people to understand that this wasn't just an experience for novice therapists. This was something that 30 years into your profession, you'll still experience difficult clinical moments in which you will be terrified and confused and upset. So that's number five. Number six, how to provide helpful supervision. I'm currently almost done with a book. Maybe by the time this episode comes out, I will be done. But I'm writing a book on supervision, and I'm talking with a lot of people about their experiences in clinical supervision. So if you're therapists out there, you know what I'm talking about. If you're not, therapists are often or are always supervised by a supervisor very closely. You know, the supervisor closely monitors their work with their clients for years. And so, for instance, in my career, I've had something like 15 supervisors over the span of a number of years. It's just something that we just do as a way of helping therapists to develop and also to monitor client welfare. And so in my research on the empirical evidence on supervision, I found that there's a high prevalence of inadequate supervision and harmful supervision. There's a lot when you survey supervisees, a lot of supervisees are saying that their supervisors aren't good enough or that their supervisors are actually harming their life. And this is my experience of supervisors. I've had, you know, like I said, 15 supervisors, and the vast majority of them were not very good. I only had a few who I would say met my expectations of what a supervisor should be. You know, someone who was helpful, someone who cared about me, someone who made me feel safe, someone who taught me, someone who mentored me. And the vast majority of my supervisors were either just sort of like, you know, meh. But then there were some that were absolutely abusive to my life and traumatizing to me. And so this is, I think, a huge problem. And in my profession, you would think we would be doing something about it, but there's very little efforts to change this. And so that's why I'm writing this book, is I want to raise awareness around this. Okay. And also provide guidance for supervisors in terms of the evidence and in terms of my experience as a supervisor. Okay, number seven, how to tailor therapy to the client instead of the other way around. Though it's archaic to me that in 2017, clients are coming to therapists who and the therapists are using their particular approach with all of their clients, regardless of the presenting issue. Now, this isn't every therapist, of course, but it's kind of the way that things are taught in general in my profession. You're, as a clinician, encouraged to learn, you know, either one or a small set of psychotherapy theories and utilize that with all of your clients. But the research shows that the best way to approach your client is to know all the theories or all the main umbrella theories, and then apply a tailored approach to that client given the situation at hand. For example, if someone comes in and they're talking about death anxiety, then existential therapy is probably called for. If someone comes in and they are ambivalent about whether or not they want to stop using cocaine, then solution-focused therapy or motivational interviewing therapy is called for, not existential and not psychodynamic. If someone comes in talking about trauma, then trauma therapy, exposure therapy, behavioral therapies, DBTs, your trauma-focused CBT models. If someone comes in and they want to explore their relationship issues that they've exhibited throughout their life, then psychodynamic, interpersonal therapies are called for, and so on, okay? A teenager comes in and is not doing well in school, but after a quick assessment, you figure out there's a lot of conflict in the home. Well, then family systems theories start to be called on. So the issue is, but the way it is now is you have people who are cognitive behavioral therapists and therefore use cognitive behavioral therapy with all of their clients. And I find this to just be atrocious. If in the medical, and I, you know, I talk about this sometimes, but in the medical field, imagine if this were true, like you have a cold and you go to a doctor, a physician, and the physician is a surgeon. And so the surgeon decides to do surgery on you because you have a cold. Well, that's absurd, right? the physician should know, no, this particular presenting problem of a cold requires not surgery. It requires a different intervention. Or you go to a physician for headaches, but that particular physician is a foot doctor, and so that doctor puts you in a brace for your foot as a way of trying to cure your headaches. This is no joke, a very apt analogy to the way psychotherapy is working today, and it shows because clients will talk about some of their past therapists as not really addressing their issues, and I think part of it has to do with this. Okay, wow. Famous patron Lyndon, you have unleashed all of my rants, as you can tell, by asking me to do a top 10. If other people want to know other top 10s, I kind of like this model here. All right. So again, number one, trauma therapy, PTSD, dissociation. Number two, anxiety. Number three, erotic countertransference and transference. Number four, how to find and understand research. Number five, how to handle and how to identify difficult clinical moments. Number six, how to provide helpful supervision. Number seven, how to tailor therapy to the client. Number eight is countertransference management. So now this probably isn't that neglected, but I think it's neglected enough in that I will talk to other therapists and I'll say, you know, first off, what is your countertransference? And they'll be like, I don't know. And I find that there's a wide range of abilities in this area. And in my mind, every therapist should be very good at this, very good at answering this question. And I find that a lot of therapists, in my estimation, could use some work in this area. And then the subsequent thing that should be talked about is how to manage that countertransference. And I'm not talking about how to suppress it. That's not what countertransference management means. It means how to know yourself, how to monitor yourself, how to monitor the relationship with the client, how to know your biases, how to know where your culture is coming from, how to know your body and your physical sensations regarding emotion, how to regulate your emotions, how to know when to try to hide that emotion from the client and when not to try to hide it from the client, when to just divulge it so that the client isn't driven crazy by knowing that you're having some feeling but you're not talking about it. Knowing how to take care of yourself, self-care after the fact, after sessions, all that kind of stuff is actually a very robust field in the field of psychotherapy. There's a lot of research. There's a lot of models of countertransference management. And if you asked a particular therapist what model of countertransference management do you use, they would say like, "Huh, I didn't know there were models." And so I find that to be one of the neglected areas of knowledge. Okay, number nine is grief therapy. So I'm almost done with my book on supervision, but I'm not almost done with my book on grief, which I've been writing for like 3 years. That's another area that, again, once I started looking into the empirical research, it's absolutely shown that a lot of therapists, a very high percentage of therapists are actually not only inadequate when talking about grief with clients, but they're actually harming clients. I can't remember the stat off the top of my head, but there's this one famous meta-analysis that demonstrated that when a person who is grieving, say from a death of a spouse or divorce or some other kind of grief, and so when a client goes to a therapist, they are something like 48% or 45% likely to be harmed by the therapy. Now, all forms of therapy for all problems, there's this percentage of people who will actually be harmed by it. For instance, when people have depression and they go to therapists, there's a 5% chance that the therapy will actually harm them. It's just one of those harm meaning that their symptoms get worse. And it's just the variance of treatment and variance in reaction to treatment. You know, you give everyone a vaccine for the flu, and a percentage of people are going to have a bad reaction to that. The vast majority of people are going to actually benefit from that, but there's always going to be some people that are going to be harmed by the treatment. Well, when it comes to grief therapies, something like in the 40s percentiles, people are actually harmed by grief treatment. And the reason for this is hypothesized by others and speculated by me, is that therapists are just woefully, terribly trained regarding grief therapy. They're not given, again, as with other topics that I've talked about, you could graduate with a doctorate or a master's that in the clinical field and not have taken any course in grief therapy. And it's a very, and not have even ever talked about grief, which is just so strange, right? That you could graduate with a doctorate or graduate with a master's in the clinical field, and having never taken a class on trauma, having never taken a class on countertransference, having never taken a class on grief therapy. It's bizarre, because grief and trauma are the most common things that people suffer from, in my estimation, that people come to therapy for. I hypothesize that actually everyone is suffering from some form of grief at all times. So to say that, to say grief therapy is just to say therapy, you know, everyone has unresolved grief from their past, whether it be their parents' divorce, or the fact that they moved to a new town and lost all their friends, or they were fired from a job, or they had to just quit a job, or a breakup. That's a big one. Everyone, you know, by a certain age has been through a difficult breakup, or divorce, or their child moves out of their house. That's a loss. Or they, I don't know, there's just, you know, or a pet dies, right? So when you add up all those losses, by the time you're 25 and forward, you will have suffered from at least one, if not a number of them, in a very significant way. And I find that most people have not been given the opportunity to properly grieve those losses. That, you know, they're devastating. And I've also known a lot of people who come to me, and after investigating, I figure out that they have a grief and a loss that they've been suffering from for decades. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just like the you know, like they were very close to their mother, and their mother dies, and, you know, and for decades after that, they're still in pain about that. And what I've discovered is it's just very normal. Whereas a lot of therapists think, oh, what's wrong with that person? So there's a lot of misconceptions about grief. And once I finish that book, I'll be talking all about it. But anyway, number 10, social constructionism, and how therapists have an ideology or a way of thinking that must be acknowledged. Social constructionism is, to me, such an obvious topic that should be known to all of us, but it's something that, for whatever reason, is just not discussed enough. I'm guessing it's because it's hard to understand. It's sort of esoteric in some ways, but in some ways, it's really just not. And it's related to countertransference. But anyway, so social constructionism and the other related fields, postmodernism, cultural relativism, these sorts of things, I think are so crucial for therapists to at least have some grasp of. Otherwise, they are at risk of really misunderstanding a lot of situations and either being not so great to their clients or even potentially harming their clients. Now, I couldn't relegate myself to 10 famous patron linens, so I have to give two more. Number 11 is how to keep proper records. I can't tell you how many times I, for those who listen to this podcast, you know that I'm one of my most favorite Schadenfreude things to do is to read these case studies of other therapists being sued by clients for doing bad things. And without fail, at least the majority of the time, one of the major problems that these clinicians will have that will result in them being sued successfully is that they weren't keeping proper records, and or they wouldn't hand over their freaking file when it was requested like they're supposed to. And so, and when I talk with other clinicians, experienced clinicians, I find that a lot of them just don't really understand the implications of what their file is. And it's not because they're stupid. It's because they're just not told. They're not taught. And I find that, and to be honest, when I was a younger supervisor, I thought I knew what a good file was supposed to look like, but I didn't really. And so I was actually teaching people how to do files that were, I just didn't know. And so it's just hard to find guidance in our field around what exactly are the factors that play into keeping good records as a therapist to protect yourself and to do good by the client. A lot of the problems actually emerge from agencies because most, if not all, therapists will begin their career at a mental health agency. And these agencies have very particular factors at play that affect the way that they keep files. And one of the factors, which is very different from other venues like private practice, is that the clients don't have much power. The clients who typically go to mental health agencies are marginalized groups. They're immigrants, they're ethnic minorities, they're poor, they're just marginalized groups who don't have much power. And so what ends up sort of happening at these mental health agencies is the way that the records are kept, they don't necessarily respect the clients very much because the clients never know that they can actually complain. Or if they do complain, they don't know who to complain to. Or if they do complain to the actual right person, they're not respected. And so there's this kind of shift away from honoring the confidentiality of the client, honoring the wishes of the client, honoring the autonomy of the client. And I see this all the time where clinicians will emerge from that mental health service world and they'll enter private practice and then they'll hire me as their supervisor. And I have to spend a lot of time reorienting their mind to putting the client first. Because if, you know, there are certain things you have to have in the file, regardless of how the client feels about it. But nothing should be in the client file that is going to piss off the client, right? I mean, presumably what you're doing, I mean, unless you're in a super adversarial relationship with the client, which can happen at times under certain circumstances, like they're court ordered or something. But for the vast majority of private practice clients, that's not the case. And so I find that I have to remind, not only just for ethics and treating clients well, but also to cover your own ass, because if in private practice your file is pulled, which happens, and it goes to court for some reason, like there's a custody battle or something, and the client reads something in your file that they're upset about that you put in there, like, you know, they masturbate to gay porn or something and they're not out as in that way, then they're going to sue you for putting that in your file, in the file, when it didn't need to be in there. Or at least they're going to be motivated to sue you, or they'll be motivated to take action against you. And for good reason, because this, did they consent to you putting that detail in their file? Did they want you to put that in their file? Did you need to put it in their file? And the answer is no. There's no purpose of putting that detail in the file. It's not needed. That's why we have psychotherapy notes, which actually are in a different file, which don't get pulled when you actually have your file pulled, which is all written out in the HIPAA rules. And so I find that I have to really beat this into people, and it takes actually a long time for me to convince people of this, of respecting clients. It's just a weird thing, you know, because in these mental service agencies, again, I'm being very general here, and I'm sure there are agencies who don't do this, but, and I actually know there are agencies who don't, but it kind of depends on the supervisor that's on site there. But in general, these mental health service agencies, they just take a very relaxed sort of point of view on that. Anyway, and my last one, number 12, is the importance of the relationship. The relationship with, so most people, most trainees, now this is changing. There's definitely an emerging loud voice from a number of people that are saying, look, the relationship is the most important thing. The relationship you have with your client is the most important thing. But a lot of trainees and a lot of therapists, frankly, are sort of socialized to focus again on theory, as I was talking earlier. They're forced to choose a theory. You got to choose cognitive behavior. You got to choose this model of therapy. But empirical science demonstrates that the variance on outcomes that the particular model has is much smaller than the variance on outcomes that the relationship has. In other words, if you want to really make sure that you raise the likelihood of positive outcomes for your clients, then you should put a lot more energy into the relationship with the client, which is sort of a humanistic, interpersonal, psychodynamic way of looking at things. You should really focus on your relationship, a positive regard, relationship rupture management, countertransference management, empathy, listening well, these kinds of things. That's what I mean by relationship. Making the client feel heard, making the client feel understood, making the client feel as though you care. These are all way more effective areas to put your energy into than any particular model. So you could be psychodynamic, you could be CBT, you could be systems, you could be neurobio person, and that's fine, but you should be much more focused on the relationship because that's where most of your outcomes variance is going to occur. And so now this is changing. More people are, I hear more therapists talking about the relationship. It's better than it was 10 or 20 years ago when very few people were talking about it. But it's getting better, but it's still mostly ignored. In my vision of the future is that all therapists consider themselves to be relationship therapists. You know, we don't really have a word for it, but maybe humanistic. Like all therapists say that they're Rogerian in some way, or all therapists will say that they have a pretty big humanistic through line in all of their therapies with their clients. You don't hear that language. You hear it. You're hearing it emerge, but not only is that empirical science, but it's also just good practice, in my opinion. I mean, imagine all of you out there listening. A lot of you probably have been in therapy, but if you haven't, just imagine you're going to a therapist. You really want your therapist to listen to you well, right? You want your therapist to understand you. You want your therapist to get you and to really, hear you and to pay attention and to care about you. You want your therapist to be very present and authentic. And if something kind of wonky happens in your relationship, like the therapist puts their foot in their mouth or something, you want that therapist to apologize and say, I'm sorry for saying that stupid thing I said last week. That is the baseline for any therapy to occur, regardless of what the problem is. It doesn't matter what the problem is. You need that relationship first. And for many people, for many clients, that relationship is the therapy because it heals the relationship problems that they experienced as children and that sort of thing. Okay, so that's my top 10 or 12 neglected areas of knowledge. Number one, trauma therapy, PTSD dissociation. Number two, anxiety. Number three, erotic transference, countertransference. Number four, how to find and understand research. Number five, how to handle difficult clinical moments. Number six, how to provide helpful supervision. Number seven, how to tailor therapy to the client. Number eight, countertransference management. Number nine, grief therapy. Number 10, social constructionism. Number 11, how to keep proper records. And number 12, the importance of the relationship. So thank you, famous patron Lyndon, for suggesting this topic. and giving me a chance to rant into a microphone while I sit alone in a room all by myself, ranting to myself and listening to myself in these headphones that I'm wearing right now. All right, well, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle. Thanks for joining me. Please take care of yourself. Let me know what you think about this episode. And take care of yourself because you deserve it.